MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Well, a whole lot of shaking going on this week. Per usual, we got troops headed toward the Middle East. And we're going to be talking about Iran with Mark Fowler, a former CIA case officer who specialized in Iran. And he's got some really interesting things to say. Meanwhile, we've got an election in Hungary that's going to open the floodgates, or it's thought that it will open the floodgates of money to Ukraine. They can put up a better fight, and they're already showing some technological prowess and intelligence prowess against the Russians. We got more Tulsi Gabbard stuff we're going to talk about. But first, I want to talk about a thing that, you know, it's one of these things that, wow, it's so, you know, it's so esoteric that it doesn't really engage the attention and the imagination of the public. But it's important, and it's in the intelligence sphere, so we're going to talk about it. And that is the renewal of a surveillance law called Section 702. Karen, dial us in on what's going on with that. It's up for renewal.
Well, it's up for renewal. It's already been extended, right? So it's up for renewal. And the House was just scheduled to vote on it, you know, a day ago, and they put it off again. It sunsets.
Imagine that, Capitol Hill putting off something.
It sunsets next week. And the reason people care about this is after a long history, which we can get into at another time, the FISA Section 702, which permits U.S. intelligence agencies to surveil foreign nationals overseas, is controversial because it has been so abused over the years. And I will say that those abuses had started to decline. There have been all these reports coming out of, you know, a number of intelligence law enforcement agencies that they weren't abusing it, but the abuse took the form of willy-nilly spying on Americans whose communications were caught up in these surveillance of these foreign nationals overseas. And then law enforcement would query that information, which had been put in search terms, to use it for their own purposes. This has always been a problem from both the right and the left on Fourth Amendment issues. And so that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the right and the left unified, those who are opposed to it, because they don't think that Americans should just be surveilled without any kind of warrant as to, you know, probable cause or, you know, what's the evidence that you need to look at this person because you think they might be guilty of some kind of crime, of some kind of espionage, of some kind of treason, whatever it is. And so we're now really in the crosshairs of it. We don't even know if Congress is going home for the weekend, if they're staying for the weekend. There's different reports coming out. Apparently, Mike Johnson, Speaker Johnson, has created an old private skiff within his own office quarters because there's so much high value that needs to go on, you know, high value conversation. And actually, it's a football we've kicked down the road over and over and over again without dealing with it. Do you need a warrant to begin to query about Americans without giving a reason? Or, you know, do you need a warrant and therefore to give a reason?
Among the opponents is said to be Tulsi Gabbard, the always fascinating Tulsi Gabbard, who's a sort of a civil libertarian on this issue. And it almost cost her nomination to be director of national intelligence until she came around. And during her confirmation hearing, she said, yeah, I like 702. I'll go along with that. But there's always something going on with Tulsi. Mike?
Yes, there
the
is.
Latest. Well, okay. First of all, she's been almost invisible on the Iran issue. And rumors have been swirling for weeks.
Right.
As they periodically do, that she's on the outs.
There was a report by The Guardian just last week that Trump was polling his advisors as to whether or not he should fire her.
So how does she react to that?
How does she respond?
She refers the former Inspector General of the intelligence community and a whistleblower to the Justice Department for prosecution over what else? Election interference for subversion of Trump over the Ukraine issue.
Yeah.
Right. This relates to the 2019 impeachment of Donald Trump over the infamous phone call he makes to President Zelensky, who has just won the election and is about to be inaugurated in July of 2019. And this is the call in which Zelensky asks Trump about the Javelin missiles, which he'd like to order to help defend against the Russians. And Trump responds, well, I'd like you to do us a favor, though. And the favor is, number one, launch an investigation into the Ukrainian role in the 2016 election. Trump, of course, is convinced that it wasn't the Russians who were meddling in our election. It was the Ukrainians trying to sabotage him. And somehow he got it in his mind that CrowdStrike, the forensic firm hired by the DNC that first uncovered the Russian hack of the DNC, was working with the Iranians, and the computer server was in Ukraine, which was kind of nonsensical. I mean,
well, did you see the headline yesterday? Yeah. That his former lawyer, Ty Cobb, said he's insane.
Yeah. Well, we've known that. Okay. So that was the first thing he asks of Zelensky, and then said, oh, yeah, also, Biden's son is in your firm, is in your country, and working for this sleazy company, Burisma, which is true. I want you to investigate them.
Well,
and investigate the son of his likely or a potential opponent at that point in the 2020 election. So what has Gabbert done? She's gone through the files and found the initial inquiries that the inspector general made of the whistleblower who first alerted Congress to this. And Gabbard's pointed out that the whistleblower said that he had no firsthand knowledge of the phone call. He participated in discussions after the phone call about what the White House should do about what Trump had just said on that phone call. That's not new. We've known that all along. And the main thing, which he does not mention at all, is we got the transcript of the phone call. Trump's pressure on Zelensky is crystal clear in the transcript. He brings up the CrowdStrike and the server. He brings up Biden's son. So whatever the whistleblower said is completely irrelevant, because we had the primary evidence upon which the impeachment was based, which was the phone call.
So we don't expect this is all.
She's referring it to the Justice Department for God knows what the potential crime here is. It's just kind of ridiculous.
But you see this as her trying to say, no, I have a purpose. No, I can serve you.
My purpose is to serve you. Correct. Master
my purpose
president.
Is to keep my job.
Yeah.
So I want to mention that I went to a symposium last night at the Hayden Center out at George Mason University on so-called Havana syndrome, also called AHI, anomalous health incidents. Very, very interesting. And what was a main point of discussion was that the various intelligence agencies, the CIA in particular, taking another look at Havana syndrome.
Ordered by Tulsi Gabbard to do doubt. Driven by Tulsi Gabbard, because she wants to blame the Biden administration for covering up Havana syndrome incidents. Yeah.
And there were remarks by people who were very close to what went on with the Biden administration. And the bottom line was, the takeaway was that the Biden administration didn't want to surface evidence that the Russians were behind these incidents because they'd have to do something about it once it became public. Anyway.
And as you know, I am a firm skeptic on this issue. Phantom attacks by phantom agents with a phantom weapon. No corroboration that the Russians have participated in any attacks, according to the CIA. They, after a lengthy investigation, they said they could not trace a single Havana syndrome incident to
any
Russian involvement. Until I see, until we get beyond phantom attacks with phantom weapons on by phantom agents,
they are phantom.
I'll accept that.
There's plenty of medical evidence.
Medical evidence of real problems these people have, no question about it.
A number of them, a lot of firsthand. Anyway, the agency is changing its opinion about this. And
Tulsi Gabbard has ordered them to change their opinion to fit the president so he can have another cudgel to bash Biden.
But, you know, I talked to former CIA director Michael Hayden after the event last night. I just went asked him what he thought about it. He said, obviously, the CIA misstepped, he said, on this issue and should have taken it more seriously when it arose. During the Biden administration. That's what he said.
Bill Burns ordered a full investigation. He started out as a believer, and after he saw the results of the CIA investigation, he apologized, said, I was wrong. You guys are right. There's no there.
Well, this issue's going away. We'll see what happens. Karen, what's on your mind?
No, this is very much on my mind, but listening to the two of you sort of debate it really tells me where could we ever get something that would be a reliable narrative that you would both buy into? Or is it really just depending on who said it? And so I'm just curious, like, what it would take to say this wasn't phantom or this was decidedly phantom.
Interesting. One thing that came up last night, Mark Polymeropoulos was on this panel, who has said and testified before Congress about his what happened to him in Moscow. He said he had conversations with Rubio, who is very interested in this issue and very sympathetic to them. And he suggested that one path forward on this in regard to Cuba, which is, of course, Rubio's obsession, is to get the Cubans as a way of smoothing the path toward a normalization of relations, to get the Cubans to admit whatever knowledge they have about the attacks that were going on the island. So, and they spoke of other senators and congressmen, members of Congress, who are also sympathetic to this issue and interested in taking it forward, feel that the government has not, the intelligence agency has not been entirely forthcoming. So anyway, it's not going away, Mike. And what your doubts,
we'll have another opportunity. Yeah.
If it's true that the agencies knew about these, you know, privately knew and accepted the idea that the
Do you really believe that the CIA deliberately covered up knowledge of Russian attacks and they lied to the public when they said, no, we can't find any evidence of any Russian involvement?
Well, according to Polymeropoulos and other people on the panel, they had a meeting with the National Security Council on this issue during the Biden administration. The Biden people said, we know what's going on, but we got to have more proof, more evidence before we do anything about it. And the stakes are very high that if this is true, and look, the Russians have a decades-long history, going back to the mid-20th century, of bombarding the American embassy in Moscow with microwaves. And they have toyed with these weapons for decades. So it's not a big leap of imagination to think that they would have developed a machine that is portable and could be directed at CIA officers in particular. And there's been recent reporting that the CIA has obtained one of these weapons. My question is, if so, let's see it. They should hold a press conference and say, here it is, or at least pictures.
So you've answered my question. You could agree on this.
Yeah.
This is what it would take.
Let's see it.
You agree on that. Good.
Fine. I was told by a former CIA ops officer 4 or 5 years ago that the CIA had obtained a weapon, had re-engineered it. And remember that Trump talked about in the Venezuela operation, he talked about the U.S. Special Operations people who captured Maduro, that they immobilized the guards around Maduro with a
discombobulator.
It discombobulated them.
Yeah.
So those aren't rubber bullets. So
okay.
My demand is you got it. Let's see it. So I mean,
the fact that we have it might be a tell. I'd say.
So anyway, well, as I said, this issue's not going away.
All right, introduce our guest. We got a great guest.
Mark Fowler, CIA officer, spent 22, 23 years in the CIA, mostly running operations as a case officer, a.k.a. an agent or spy recruiter and handler. Has dealt with Iranians for years, recruiting people who are nuclear scientists and Iranian officials to tell us what's been going on. And by his account, we were really good at that. Of course, there was a time that we weren't because they intercepted our communications, the CIA's covert communications plan. And they not only wrecked the CIA's operations in Iran, they told the Chinese about how we were operating according to reports. And the Chinese were able to roll up a whole bunch of our agents in China. Anyway, Mark wrote a very interesting piece about the negotiations with the Iranians in the Washington Post recently. We're going to start asking him about that. But we have lots more to cover with Mark Fowler. And without another moment, let's bring him on. Mark Fowler, welcome to Spy Talk. In a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, which was fascinating, among other things, you wrote that case officers are cautioned to be specific, to say what they mean and mean what they say. That was the only way Iranian contacts came to understand and to believe that we could be trusted, leading to a productive relationship. You spent years recruiting Iranians to spy for us against the regime. We have thousands of troops headed toward the Middle East right now. What's the message this is sending to the Iranians, and what are they hearing with this?
Thanks for having me, Jeff, and Karen and Mike. Frankly, I think what they're hearing is a mixed message right now, and we're all hearing a mixed message. So the regime has sort of gotten the military message. There's no question about that. That's been pretty explicit and very direct. The Iranian people themselves are hearing a mixed message. We've seen multiple different justifications, if you will, coming from the White House in terms of why this is being done. Started with nuclear, sort of worked its way back to nuclear again. I think that's where we are currently. But I think. When I talked about saying what you meaning what you say, saying what you mean, part of that it has to do with trust. The Iranians are very it's very hard to actually develop trust with the Iranians because they've been it's just in their nature. They don't trust each other many times until they get to know each other. And of course, for someone like me who dealt with people under stress and under unusual circumstances, they were extremely nervous about who we were and what we were. Our reputation exceeds us for the most part. And so they never quite knew what to make of what we were saying. So what they hear, what we say and what they hear can be two different things. And that's why I said that it's very important, at least when we were doing our work as case officers for myself and for the people that worked for me, we had to be very careful what we said and what we thought our counterpart, the person we were talking to, what they actually heard, because they had a tendency to hear what they wanted to hear.
You said, in your very prescient piece, you said that signing a contract for the Iranians is just the starting point. They contract and then they figure they'll start negotiating.
That's right.
So what should we be looking for this week?
Well, I mean, process of negotiation with Iranians is a long, painful process. And certainly what we just saw in Islamabad, 21 hours, I think, and marathon process, that was pretty much from the beginning doomed. No, I shouldn't say doomed, but it probably wasn't going to go anywhere. In terms of how they receive this. Their idea of negotiating is a long, drawn-out process. There's no question about that. And part of, we heard this from, I think it was Kalibaf, who was there, who actually said they didn't develop trust in the American group that was there. It doesn't happen overnight. It just doesn't. It's just the process here. Historically and personally, it takes a long time for Iranians to learn to trust somebody. And it's not a question of you're my best friend or anything like that. It's just, can I trust what you're saying is actually the truth and that you're not trying to cheat me? Because that's kind of where they come from. The way they approach it, whether it's a person like me who is dealing with them on matters of national security or negotiating at a high level. I'm not talking about just making nice and, you know, developing the relationship per se, but it is for them basically coming to a point where they believe that you're here in good faith and that they can at least trust to have a real conversation, that you're listening to them and that the things that you're saying is taking into account what their issues as well. You can't just come in and dictate to them, and you can't come in and be imperious. That just sends everything off the rails immediately in terms of how they will react.
So, Mark, you obviously speak with great authority based on your many years of dealings with the Iranians. So I want to hear more about that. You had, some 23 years in the CIA. Walk us through how you got there and how you ended up being known as an Iran hand at the agency.
Right. Well, I EOD'd, entered on duty in 1984. So it was 5 or so years after the revolution, obviously. When I entered on duty, I didn't have Farsi. I'm a Farsi speaker, although I'm rusty now. We'll say that right up front. And what happened was initially they had told me, congratulations, you're going to Calcutta, India as your first tour. Because I was in any division. We called it any Near East division back then. But it turned out that someone else dropped out of Farsi. They were a class ahead of me. So they were months ahead of me. And so serendipity, frankly, I heard there might be an opening and I mentioned it to the personnel officer. I said, is there a possibility of this? And he said, sure. And we looked into it and I just kind of slotted into it. And so it was really serendipitous. I actually wanted to be a China ops officer, but that it's just one of those things, you know, these things, you can't always control that. So I ended up in my first tour in a place called Tehran. It was the Tehran Station in Exile. That was in Germany. That's well known. Which is a little unusual. Usually first tour officers go to somewhere and do very, very normal, you know, just on the street, spotting, assessing, developing, recruiting, handling some assets, et cetera. That's the usual thing. And so what I did was essentially with a group of us, we were in Germany and we flew around the world dealing with Iranians. Most of them were walk-ins. You know what a walk-in is? It's a volunteer, someone who actually, back then it was physically walking in. Now it can be virtual.
An embassy would just show up at an embassy.
Yeah, they just show up at the guards and say, I want to talk to a U.S. official. Or half the time it was, I want to talk to the ambassador. So they didn't know. Sometimes they would come in and say, I want to talk to the CIA. Just depended on who they were and how bold they were. So a lot of times we were brought in to deal with walk-ins, which is a whole different thing than sitting down and developing someone over, you know, months. Because they couldn't be seen with us. It was very, very difficult. So I did that for a couple of years. And I had some other tours and did some other things as well, just sort of like normal tours, if you will, just doing regular case officer stuff. And I ended up back in Washington, and I was in what was called ITF, which was the Iran Task Force, which is a precursor to what they have now, which is a larger group, the Iran Operations Group within Middle East Center. And I was there for about 4 years, and I started out as a deputy in the what they called external, which was, you know, working around the world to recruit Iranians, et cetera. And then I became chief internal, which was essentially the backroom kind of thing. I was responsible for managing all of our spies that we were running inside Iran. And eventually after that, I also became chief ops and then the deputy within the same group. So I had 4 different jobs in about 4 years. So I spent a lot of time working on Iran in my career. Not always, but
yeah. So there's a lot there that I'd love to ask you about, but let's start out towards the end of your time. I think you were there till 2007.
Yeah, about
if that. That's
right.
Yeah. Now, after the Iraq War, in which commenced in 2003, there was a lot of talk about Iran would be next, and that Vice President Cheney, in particular, believed that the Iranians were working to get a nuclear bomb, and the only way to stop them was some sort of military intervention. And then there was an agency assessment that said the Iranians were not actively working on a nuclear bomb. So that was right towards the end of your tenure. Walk us through the circumstances around that. And if you were indeed convinced at the end of your tour that the Iranians were not fixated on assembling a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, well, at that point, actually, the summer of 2003, I was the number two on Iraq, believe it or not. So I wasn't focused on Iran, but they were right across the hall, frankly, and I knew the chief over there. So I was, you know, I kept up with it. And obviously, it's all related. Mm-hmm. I think partially they saw us head into Iraq, and they were convinced that we were going to take a sharp right and head into Iran after that. It's just, to them, it made sense. And they were, because everybody was shocked. I think everybody was shocked when we went into Iraq. But we had real information indicating they had stopped weaponization or development of their weapons program. They were still enriching in some manner, and but we actually had real information.
Why was that, Mark? Why do you think that they stopped the weaponization?
Well, I think they were literally afraid that, you got to understand how the Iranians think, for sure, and a lot of other people in that part of the world. They think we know everything. They just assume. Half the time I would sit with someone and he says, well, you know everything anyways. Why are you asking me all these questions?
We think we know everything.
No, well, you're right. Some people do, but we certainly don't. So they thought they just assumed that we'd know what they were doing, and we pretty much did. It's not just us, and others were working on it too, as you can imagine. So we knew for a fact that they had stopped working on the program. And I think they did it because they thought if they did that, then we'd know. And then we wouldn't come for them, because this is not something just to do willy nilly. I mean, this is what we're talking about now in terms of, you know, boots on the ground. We already had boots on the ground in Iraq, but still, that's the only thing that really scared them, the Iranians, over the years, was a large boots on the ground of U.S. forces, you know, combined arms, of course. But that's the thing that scared them most. They thought they could handle pretty much everything else.
Some would say that suggests that they do indeed respond to military pressure.
I mean, they did at that point. They'll respond at certain points if the pain point is high enough, or if they determine that it's just existential. As you remember when Ayatollah Khomeini, the first imam, said, "I'm drinking from the poison chalice," when they made peace with the Iraqis. That was pretty painful, but it was literally bleeding them dry. And it can be done. It's a decision they'll make. But at the same time, there has to be, we hadn't gone in yet. So frankly, for them to sort of step back from their weapons program, not just enrichment, but the broader program, that was essentially easy to do. And I think they all knew, and the Iraqis knew it too. We heard this from Iraq. That's one of the reasons Saddam got rid of his programs. They knew if they went too far in certain programs, WMD, certainly nuclear, that it was the end, because we would come for them.
Was this about the time of the Ayatollah's fatwa?
I don't remember when he put it out, but he issued it several times, and it was the real thing,
saying that there should not be nuclear.
That's correct. They said it was not Islamic, and they were not seeking a nuclear weapon. And I mean, I think at that point that's what he was thinking. What they focused on was maintaining the threshold capability, or the ability, should they choose to move towards it. But, and they could always change their mind, of course, because they had all the elements of putting a program together. Weapon is a whole different thing. Weaponization, the actual device, is a whole nother thing. And, of course, delivery.
So if you knew for a fact in 2007 that they were not developing nuclear weapons, at some point, did that change from what you understand?
Well, I mean, not that I understand, not anything that I've seen. After I left, of course, I didn't have the same access, but I actually worked in, after I left, I worked for Booz Allen for about 7 years, but I went back in because I missed it, frankly. And I was, until just a couple of years ago, I was going back and forth overseas, helping out, if you will, as a contractor. So I saw a lot of stuff. And as far as I understand, as far as I saw, they had not stepped back into, you know, the actual weapons program itself. Again, that's different than the uranium enrichment.
Yeah. How do you explain the enrichment to levels far above civilian use?
It's Iranians being Iranian. They're always going to push the envelope. I think obviously they reacted to, essentially they reacted to President Trump pulling out of the JCPOA is what they did. And they're stubborn. There's no question about it. And they're proud. And it's you're not the boss of me is kind of the way they approach things. And the harder you press and try to be the boss of them, the more they're going to push back. So I think they were just making a point and saying, if you're going to do that, we're going to do this. But they only went so far, obviously. 60% is very high. It's not, I think it's, you know, just below weapons grade. But I don't know how that works, but 60 to 90 or whatever you need is not a big jump. It's the hard part is the early stages. Once you get to like 60% or plus, getting to where you want to be to the end is actually pretty simple if you have the equipment, and they do.
I just want to follow up on a little bit of this and bring it more into now, which is that you keep saying, you know, they don't trust us. But when I listen to you talk, I get the, you know, the line that we don't trust them. And so, and you also said that the negotiations in Islamabad were sort of doomed from the beginning. So I'd just like to get a sense of, is there any scenario in which we'd trust them? And if that was the case, who would that be, given that we don't have, you know, who's in charge, who's actually in charge? And just a little bit more about why you think the Islamabad negotiations were sort of a non-starter from the start.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, well, we'll start with the last one first, I guess. I mean, as I understand it, again, I'm just going by the press, obviously, and you guys have seen everything I've seen. It appears what happened, you know, 21 hours of even marathon talks is nothing. I mean, any other agreement that is substantive, and this is significant, takes months, if not years. So essentially, I think what they probably went in and is put their demands on the table, our side. And the Iranians were there to listen. Certainly, they had their maximalist demands as well, and most of them were ridiculous. And ours are, I say ridiculous, but I mean, they're what we wanted. And it appears what happened is they kind of put them on the table, and the Iranians were there to see what we were going to offer, if there was a way forward, because they know they're on the ropes, militarily at least. And so I think they probably came to listen and figure out whether, you know, these are people we could deal with, if you want to use that term. But they probably found out that, you know, they were just putting down, we would call them red lines, but just terms. And it says you need to agree to these. And, you know, they couldn't. My understanding is they were essentially, they weren't empowered. I'm sure they were not empowered to go too far. They were there. They were empowered to listen and figure out, you know, where do we go from here? So that's why that just, it didn't go very far in terms of trust, in terms of, I mean, you know, it's trust, but verify. It's more than that. Obviously, actions, not words. The Iranians, in terms of trust, I think my personal view is the JCPOA, as flawed as it was in some respects, it was a trust-building exercise. What it did was address the most important issue on the table, which was the nuclear program, the nuclear enrichment program. And the Iranians really did, you know, open up quite a bit. The terms that they agreed to were pretty onerous. Including, you know, shutting down Iraq, which was, you know, I think it was the plutonium reactor, if I'm not mistaken. And they, you know, and IAEA inspections, cameras, et cetera. They actually stepped forward and I don't want to say you call it good faith. And I think it was a way to figure out, can we do business? And for the Iranians, of course, under Khamenei, who's dead now, He didn't trust us at all. He thought that any sort of process that led to coming to terms with us would corrupt what he had built. He and Khomeini, the original imam, had built. A lot of this is just pushing it off as long as they could. I say delaying tactics, you can call it that. But I mean, in terms of trust, I mean, when you only see people a couple of times, I mean, they saw them, they came to a pretty good agreement, I think, in the JCPOA. And that was certainly not going to happen in 21 hours this time, especially after we just finished killing, frankly, even the two guys across the table, I think Kalibaf and Al-Arakchi, we killed like most of their friends. They were, you know, barely in their graves. And so you don't just walk in the door and say, well, you know, let's, you know, you try to force, but that's where things go wrong. You try to force the Iranians, they're going to dig in. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. No, I just wanted to get a sense that this is really fractured on both sides, yes, you know, yes. In some very fundamental ways.
Yep.
You know, getting back to the JCPOA, one of the things you write about, which I think is very persuasive, is, and Jeff started with his quote with it, which is the need for specifics. Stop talking about just these big grandiose concepts and let's get down to specifics. So in addition to the nuclear specifics, some of which you referred to before, what are the other kinds of specifics that you think are going to be needed in order for any holding agreement to take place?
Well, I mean, that's where in my piece, I talked about hyperbolating. I made up a word. And essentially, that's where we are right now. And it's also in the public domain, which is not the way to negotiate. I mean, we all know that. You can't really do that, especially when you're at odds, especially under fire, if you will. So it's, you know, you've got to be able to sit down and talk through. You know, they've put out some really maximalist demands. We've got some too. You know, just take the uranium thing. They want to continue in some manner. I don't know what that means. There's been a couple of, you know, years of 20, 5, 10, who knows? We say never. And, you know, of course, they could agree to that, and that wouldn't necessarily hold forever as well. So I'm not sure the point of that. But we need to get right there. But they'll never start with specifics ahead of time. The way I always found Iranians is the Farsi is the language of poetry, Rumi, et cetera. So it's very easy to sort of talk in concentric circles for them. And they can do that. And it's just the way they think. It's because that's their culture. And so they'll start large and they'll winnow down towards the specifics. You don't get there right away. Now, when it was someone like me who's sitting there with a walk-in or somebody else or an asset, you know, someone who was recruited and they're yelling about money or they're yelling about something, you know, you need to speak plainly, specifically right then and there. You need to sort of bear down on it immediately. You don't have a lot of time. You know, these things are sometimes hours long, maybe a couple of days. You don't have months and you need to make a decision. So so in specifics, I mean, obviously the big one, at least in terms of what President Trump keeps going back to, is nuclear, obviously the enrichment. But obviously the proxies is a huge issue. The Iraqi militias, Hezbollah is the big one. And that's obviously a whole nother issue in terms of, you know, Israel's not going to let that go. I don't think. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I think they see an opportunity here to defang completely Hezbollah. And I don't think they're going to let it go. My friends, that's what I think anyways.
Dude, just picking up on that, Mark, it seems to me, you know, the JCPOA, I mean, didn't deal at all with Iran's malign activity in the region, the support for Hezbollah and Hamas. And I think at this point in time, it seems to me that's actually more significant than the nuclear program, because there can never be peace in that region as long as Hezbollah and Hamas are active and attacking Israel. Israel will respond. You know, it'll inevitably escalate. Could the Trump administration accept a deal that doesn't require Iran to stop its support for two terrorist groups in the region?
I don't think they should, frankly. Hezbollah is a malignant organization. They've destroyed Lebanon. I spent some time in Lebanon not too long ago, a couple of months. And it's a lovely place. I don't know if you've ever been there. I mean, it's wonderful. The people are great. But
I have.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, yeah. You know, I mean, they've been there since 82, whatever. And it's a it's an intimidation, obviously. They've basically rendered them, the government of Lebanon, moot. I mean, they're able to mandate what happens through through their military force. So I personally think that the Iranians will not want to, but I think we need to make sure that it happens. I'm not sure what that means, frankly. What they're doing right now is the Lebanese government under Joseph Fayoum is indicated they want to reestablish state sponsor of armed forces, if you will. I think that's the way to go. And he sees an opportunity, I assume. I think they've agreed to new talks and a ceasefire that just came out, I think, this morning, right? But I don't think we're ever going to get the Iranians to agree to it, but we may have to just make it a fact, to be honest with you. I'm not sure how that's going to play out. But the Israelis are not going to let it go, I don't think. I really don't think. They're right there on the border. They can't allow them to maintain their menacing presence, if you want to call it that.
Mark, this is great. We have to step away for just a second for our commercial sponsors. And we're back. Mark, what do you think about the threat to send ground troops in to capture the enriched uranium? What do you think the Iranians are thinking about that? Do they see that as an empty boast?
Yeah. I'm not sure they see anything as an empty boast at this point, given the fact that we did something I don't think they ever thought we would do, which is, you know, attack them. But they're probably ready for it. I assume they are. I mean, it's Isfahan, which is, it's not right on the coast. We'd have to go deep into the country. I think they probably are preparing for it right now. If in fact they do it, maybe it's still a bargaining chip. I would assume, knowing how they work, not that I'm an expert on negotiations per se, that the actual release or turning over the enriched uranium is not necessarily off the table. They've done it before. They did it in the previous JCPOA. And then I'm not saying it's not impossible that they could agree to that, somehow digging it up and turning it back over. But, you know, it's going to take some negotiation. Again, it's not going to happen over a couple of hours. But I'm sure they're taking it somewhat seriously. But at the same time, all they have to do is listen to the news, and it's clear they do. All you have to do is watch their Lego videos, which are quite something. They actually know what's going on here. But if they understand that this is a sort of like a whole nother reach, if you will, putting boots on the ground, and not just on Karg Island. That's one thing. That's on the coast. This is in the interior of the country. That would take a whole nother level of everything, frankly. And it would probably entail casualties, et cetera, et cetera. So if I had to guess, I'd say speculate. They probably think it's less likely than likely, but you can't take anything off the table, can you?
You know, it seems to me, from what you said about your understanding of Iranian culture, Iranians and so on, that there could be a melding of the Iranian approach to negotiations and what Trump needs. Some kind of victory, something to walk away with. The Iranians could agree, you know, to some arrangement.
They could.
Which, as you say in your Washington Post piece and so on, that's just their starting point. So they would agree and then drag out the process of whatever it is, reducing or giving up some of their uranium, or saying they're never going to say they're going to withdraw support from Hezbollah. But they'd agree to something, and Trump could say, yeah, see, I won this. I won the war.
Right. No, I think President Trump would probably accept anything that is just slightly better than what President Obama had, whatever that means, or at least that he could spin. But it's got to be better. It can't be less. Now, that's tricky. But I think that's probably what he's looking for. If I had to speculate, again, that's speculation.
I just had a question about something you wrote a couple of months ago about the country being dissatisfied with being run by clerics, and sort of this, like, you know, grassroots dissatisfaction, which I think we've read that the Trump administration was counting on in part when, you know, they launched this war. So my question is what happened? Why did that, you know, idea of dissatisfaction sort of take root and see it in the streets, et cetera, et cetera? Was it a miscalculation, a misunderstanding to begin with, or did things change because of the nature of what the United States did, or how do you see it?
I would say yes to all that. No, that,
so we got it wrong in part?
No. Well, it's a combination of things, obviously. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of discontent, if you will, inside Iran, among the people. And, you know, let's face it, whether or not they're religious or not, and a lot of people are, you know, they're like Christians who go to church, you know, twice a year or something like that. And then there's obviously the devout ones that are praying three times a day or whatever. So obviously there's a lot of discontent, but a lot of this comes down to simple, you know, the economy's terrible. They're literally running out of water, and this government that's been in power since 1979, essentially, they're adding to these problems. They're adding to real problems that, in terms of, you know, what's important to people. It's just like here, you know, what's important to people? It's the price of gas. There, it's the price of gas, and they've had they literally have had protests over that as well. I think it was 2019, maybe, and they killed a bunch of people over that too because it started to get out of hand. So people are upset. There's no question about it. But obviously, we saw. When they had the really large ones, the countrywide ones, that they were just really starting to push back. I think it really scared the regime, but they killed tens of thousands. I don't think we really know. It's 20, 30, 40, who knows? And obviously they've proven to these people that if you step out of line, we're going to whack you. In terms of opposition inside, because that's what you're asking about, I think. I think it's there, but the Iranians are very good at keeping it fragmented. And there is, you know, it's been sort of noted in the press, et cetera. There's no visible leadership, and that's a strength and a weakness. The strength, of course, is they can't find that person and, you know, cut them. There's no, I don't want to say Che Guevara, that's probably not the right term, but there's no person who's the leader inside. And there's really no one outside. You know, the two I've heard, obviously, is Reza Pahlavi. But he's never been a real, you know, factor. Even when I was in the 80s, I mean, he just wasn't. And then the other one is the MEK, Mujahideen al-Khalq, who they're somewhat effective in certain ways, and they can do certain things, but the Iranian people hate them in general.
What about the Kurds? What do you think about arming the Kurds in this situation?
Well, they're all armed anyway, so all they've got guns always. Well, I love the Kurds. I love the Kurds. No, not necessarily. I never dealt with PJAK, which is the Iranian Kurds per se. I've dealt with the Iraqi Kurds, and I always thought they should have gotten Kurdistan after the war, but that's a whole different thing. I mean, no, that's a very delicate and a very tricky question, simply because the Kurds are a specific ethnic group, obviously, and their goal has always been to sort of separatist kind of thing, and that's not necessarily what we're looking for. I mean, there's Azeris, there's Baluchis, there's, you know, a bunch of Turkmen, you know, other. But most Iranians see themselves as Iranians. They just do. I'm not so sure about the PJAK guys anymore because they've been at this for decades now. But I don't think in general that probably would have been the way forward. Now, maybe as part of something larger. But the whole issue is, and I wrote about this in some of my pieces. I had my first Washington Post, and I've written it in some of my other, in my Substack pieces, those articles. Bottom line is that's sort of more along the lines of covert action kind of stuff in terms of, you know, whether arming them, but it's not just guns. They got lots of guns. We give them more, of course, but it's, you know, sort of direction, intelligence, and what are we going to do? What's your goal? But it's pretty clear that no planning was done for this. I had sort of presupposed or hoped that when they looked like we were going to do this, because that was my first article, I think, in the Post. And I said, you know, but this presupposes that they've done some planning, and shame on them if they haven't. Well, shame on them. And it appears the only place he got the idea it might happen, it was from Netanyahu, who said, oh, yeah, they'll fall. We'll go in.
Well, along those lines, you know, the New York Times recently had this extraordinary reporting about the briefing that Netanyahu gave President Trump and the national security establishment. And he said, you know, he had 4 points. We could take out the Ayatollah. We could destroy the missile and nuclear, what's left of the nuclear program. And point three, that would lead to street protests, and then point four, ultimately regime change. If you were in the room when he was giving that briefing, and the next day when the Radcliffe right. and folks came back to him, what would you have said?
Well, I mean, he said the right thing. It is, if he didn't have a very significant, substantial portfolio to go along with his claims, which obviously he didn't. I mean, you know, because I hate to say it, but
you're talking about Netanyahu.
Yes. I don't know if he had something he gave to them, but obviously, you know, doing that in the briefing with the president probably wasn't going to, you know, the attention span thing in terms of. But unless there was a lot more to go with that, and if you just claimed, you know, our people say that they're going to go, you know, they're going to rise up, that is farcical, frankly. These things.
That's what Radcliffe said.
Yes, he said it for a good reason. You know, I mean, I was in there doing these kind of things. I did a lot of stuff on Iraq, and I worked on Iran for years, obviously. And these things just don't happen. I mean, it takes months and years to build either networks. You have to have intelligence networks that are actually providing the actual good intelligence, which is not what we had on Iraq, but that's a whole nother story. I could talk about Iraq forever too. But I think our intelligence is much better on Iran, and certainly the Israelis' networks and or intelligence is superb. We've seen that. Really good. But I don't know what that means in terms of what they had done. You don't just, there's one thing, you have obviously the ability to reach out and touch people. And this is before the war, obviously. They were doing this on a selective basis, a lot of nuclear scientists and others, but they could make people go away. And so they obviously had a lot on the ground, but it's a different thing when you're trying to foment some kind of uprising, if you will. You know, you have to, I mean, the way to do it is, frankly, in a place like Iran, is you got to find the security guy, the general, or whether it's regular army or IRGC. Because they'll do it if under the right circumstances, perhaps. You just have to find the right guy. Regular army, you know, you got to find the right guy who can move troops, et cetera, who can provide you with the beginning point, at least, and will allow you to move. But that doesn't just happen.
The last line of your most recent piece is, the more likely outcome of the conflict is both sides declaring victory and the U.S. withdrawing, leaving the Persian Gulf and the Iranian people in a severe state of flux at the mercy of an enraged, wounded regime.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, we're talking about, I think we all.
So there's no winner.
No, this is only bad situations. I mean, you know, it's one of the articles I wrote in my Substack was the least worst option, you know, the Argo thing. And that's true. I mean, there's no good solution here. And I, you know, anybody who says there's an easy solution or it's simple or whatever is a fool, frankly. Anybody would say that or think that. There's no good way out of this. You know, we need the wisdom of Solomon at this point, and I'm pretty sure we don't have that. But, you know, it's going to leave an embittered, a very angry, and a not completely defanged regime in Iran, who are going to be looking across the Persian Gulf at their Gulf Arab friends, if you will, and they're going to turn on the Iranian people. I mean, they may have cowed them to a large extent, but they, just from the previous protests not that long ago, and others who are, you know, probably saying things or doing things, they're watching these people, the security forces are, and they're going to turn on them because they've, again, remember, you know, 40 plus or many more of senior IRGC and others, they're gone, they're dead. And they see these people as traitors. So the people of Iran are really going to suffer. The Gulf Arabs are going to feel their wrath as well. I'm convinced of that. If they are left in place and they're left with the ability to reconstitute their power projection internally, it's a different thing. All it takes is machine guns and, you know, jeeps and, you know, stuff like that.
My last question is about spying on Iran. You're an expert on that.
Well, specialist, not an expert.
Well, you've dealt with a lot of Iranians and recruited them over the years. Have you heard anything about key sources of ours who may have been killed in the bombings that wiped out their leadership? And two, if you're ahead of an Iran ops group right now, what are you looking for? Are you going to rely more on electronic intelligence, intercept, and so on, because it's so dangerous to operate in Tehran now? What's your approach?
Well, I mean, I have no information in terms of, you know, if we lost any assets, you know, in the bombings. And I mean, it wasn't like thousands were killed. I mean, it was a couple of dozen, whatever. If we had one of those guys, it would be great. And these things happen when, and this has been written about in Iraq, when we hit Sajid's farm, the initial strike in Iraq, we killed one of our really good sources there. He was there on the ground. That's why we knew that something was going on. There were meetings going on. So this can happen, but I have no information specifically on that. In terms of going forward, like I said, it's pretty clear that the Israelis have very good intelligence. There's no question about that. I have to assume, because we put a lot of effort into this too, that we do as well. I mean, the electronic stuff is always out there, and the cyber things, you know, these things are, frankly, I don't say easy. They're complicated, but you know, you can reach in. You don't have to physically put yourself there. But Humint, in my view, is becoming even more important in today's world, because whether it's the AI stuff or, you know, even SIGINT, things like that, when you're doing signals there. And again, I'll go back to Iraq simply because it's sort of paints a picture. We had SIGINT from senior people, you know, colonels and generals and troop leaders and stuff saying, we're going to use special weapons against the Americans as they come towards Baghdad. And everybody just said, oh, my God, it's chemicals and, you know, and all that stuff. What they meant was they're going to use their good missiles and their good, you know, artillery shells and stuff like that. That's what it turned out to be. So you got to be careful, because and whether it's documents or SIGINT or whatever, I used to say the documents are dumb. It says the same thing with SIGINT. You only know what they say, and what they say is not necessarily the truth. They may be speaking not truth to power, or they may just be misinformed, et cetera. So I think Humint is very important right now. And I think, you know, I'm assuming, I'm hoping against all hope, that our Humint sources inside Iran are significant and are providing good intelligence. That appears to be the case, but that doesn't necessarily translate into whether it's regime change or whatever. It depends on where they are. And also, most assets have a shelf life. In that sense, whether it's like, I've done my bit, I want to go to America now, or they die, unfortunately, or they get caught. There's any number of ways these things, they don't go forever. They just don't. So timing is important as well.
Okay, Mark, this has been very fascinating and informational. So I really appreciate your coming on the show today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
And we will be following you on Substack and in more op-ed pieces in the Washington Post.
Can I give the handle of my Substack? Is that okay?
Sure.
It's at Malfow5, MALFOW, the number 5, at Malfow5. And also, if I can, just real quick, and you can see it on my Substack, I'm writing espionage novels and hope they'll be published soon, I hope. And the first one, just I could tell you, it actually is a little bit relates. The first one is called A Prince of Mirrors. And it's a fictional version of Iranian retaliation for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. So it kind of relates to, and it's pretty interesting, I think, anyway.
It's perfect
when is
for
this
return
be done?
Appearance on Spy Talk.
Wait, when is that going
to
be done?
Well, the actual, I've written it, it's done, and I'm getting ready to publish it. I have a website, and that can be found through my Substack pretty soon. Frankly, I don't want to bore everybody, but I had an agent for a while, a real agent. But getting an espionage novel published is extremely difficult. It just is.
Oh,
they're not that interested.
Wow.
It's mostly romance novels right now or whatever. It's just the way traditional publishing is. So,
book agents, if you're listening to this podcast, get in touch with us. We'll put you in touch with Mark.
Great.
Best of luck, Mark.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll certainly take note of your book when it comes out. That's for sure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Okay. See you around. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.